Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our morning panel.
Whatever.
Very nice to have you with us. I'm sorry.
A coffee clatch.
Yeah, I just realized it was this thing like just flashed on my screen that there was breaking news, and I thought it was like something really important, like the world was coming to an end, and it was just a spam.
Yeah, and one of the worst things that has ever happened on CNN is they figured out that if you every moment you say breaking news and you say breaking news, some guy just scratches his head. That's what
they have to put it up. But I mean, this one just like popped up on my screen, so I got nervous. But I'm okay now. Thank you for asking.
Highly informed.
Good morning. Welcome to the panel. I'm Joe Donahue. Let me introduce everyone to you. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir.
How'd you do? How'd you do? How's your mother? How's your brother? How are you?
All fine.
I learned that on Fire Island.
Got it right in there, didn't you? Every program manages to get it in there.
Rosemary Armeo is here. How are you feeling?
I'm exhausted. I had a thrilling day yesterday in New York City, and I'm paying for it now from lack of sleep.
Yes, you
are.
It was
worth it.
And who was your co-compatriot?
I went with
I don't want to start rumors, but who did you
My mother actually asked me quite a bit about that.
Is that right?
Yeah. My companion was the Joe Donahue, the expert New York City show tour guide. Holy cow, it was amazing. We just packed in every minute from the second we left Albany till we came back.
That is true.
Well, what'd you do?
We went to see the Colbert Show.
Yeah.
Then ate quickly. It just kind of was a lump in my stomach. Then we ran to the Alice and Janney play, 6 Degrees of Separation. It was, and both were magnificent.
Well, what time did they do the show, the Colbert Show?
5. Well, we had to be there. We had to be there at like 3:30, and then they finally started at like 5.
Yeah.
So when you watch it in the middle of the night, it's not really.
No.
It's a live taping.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, and then you went to a play.
And then we went to go see 6 Degrees of Separation with Alice and Jenny. It was.
And Joe's like this groupie. I didn't know this. We had to wait at the stage door after both shows.
Oh.
And we took selfies with them. We got autographs. It was, I have a picture of me with Alice and Jenny because of Joe Donahue.
And she is again?
Well, she was C.J. Craig on The West Wing.
I told her,
really?
You're a whole lot better than Sean Spicer. We're realizing that. She goes, C.J. was. You know, like it's a separate person from her.
Yeah, they get that a lot.
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. It was absolutely one of those days, I've said this, that when you have lousy, awful days in the future, you look back and say, oh, remember that day? So that will be one
That's
for
wonderful.
Me.
That's wonderful.
We had a lot of fun. It was very, very cool. I want to announce that our friend, I assume he'll be our friend. How could he not be?
Never know.
He's the former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture under President Obama. Tom Vilsack will be with us momentarily. We're waiting for his arrival. He has arrived, actually. So let's go take a break, and we'll get him seated, and then we will start our program and talk to Secretary Vilsack about how things are now since he left the USDA. We'll be right back after this break. Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable. We are thrilled to introduce our special guest on the panel this morning. Tom Vilsack will receive the Honorable James P. King 59 Lifetime Achievement Award today by the Albany Law School, and why not? He is the former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture under President Obama, a longtime governor. He was the 30th U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. He was the 40th governor of Iowa and currently president and CEO of the U.S. Dairy Export Council. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Tom Vilsack to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's great to be back in Albany.
How did you come? You were from Iowa.
Well, actually, I was originally from Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay.
Pennsylvania, and I went to school in upstate New York at Hamilton College in Clinton, and there I met Christy Bell, who was a student at Kirkland College. She is from Iowa, small town in Iowa, southeast part of the state. We fell in love and got married, and we lived in Richfield Springs while she taught at Waterville in 8th grade, 9th grade, and 12th grade, and I went to school here at Albany Law School.
Wow. Very nice.
Yeah.
You know where Ames, Iowa is?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
One of my best friends in the world is from Ames. He was my roommate.
I'm assuming as governor you have to know every.
Well, there are 953 cities and towns in Iowa, so I'm not sure I know all of them. But my wife has been to most of them because she was a big proponent of the libraries. But Ames is the home of the Iowa State Cyclones. Iowa State University is located there.
Well, sir, let us ask you
something.
Good news. What, good news since you left, right?
What
you left
the hell your agency? Has happened since you left?
Well, look, elections have consequences, don't they?
Now, let me just set this up because I believe you were the only member of the cabinet who was there from start to finish.
Sean Donovan was there from start to finish, but he switched jobs. Housing and Urban Development Secretary, and then he became the OMB Director, the Office of Management and Budget. But he and I were the only folks who stuck it out the entire period.
So President Obama asked you to be the Secretary of Agriculture, and upon taking office, and you stayed through the entire administration.
I was fortunate to have been confirmed the day after the inauguration and sworn in that day and started. And I left on January 13th. My wife and I had decided to take a vacation, and the vacation was out of the country, and I didn't want the security detail to have to take me out of the country and then halfway through the vacation to leave because I was no longer going to be secretary at the
That's
end of
funny.
It. So to save the taxpayers a few bucks, I left it.
Oh, we don't do that anymore. We just go on vacations and charge it.
Didn't you just want to get out of town? Seriously, want to leave?
It's tough. It's tough. It's very hard to. I've spent my life in government, 30 years. I was a mayor of a small town. I was a state senator. I was a governor and a secretary. And in each one of those jobs, I understood and appreciated the role that government plays in our life, the positive role. And it's really hard to watch people constantly criticize what government does without really reflecting on the tremendous things it does for us. So, for example, my department, during the 8 years I was secretary, invested somewhere in the neighborhood of over $50 billion in the state of New York and in the rural areas of New York State. Now, you say $50 billion with a B, what possibly could you have done with those monies? Well, we helped to finance home ownership for people in rural communities like Richfield Springs. A lot of people can't get commercial loans for houses. They can't afford the down payment because they're working two jobs and are just basically making it, but they want that home ownership, the pride of home ownership. USDA provided over a million loans while I was secretary. We invested in water projects. 21 million Americans throughout the United States in rural areas have cleaner water because of the investments that were made during the Obama administration. This is just an example of what we invested in at USDA. Now, I'm sure every other department of government had similar stories. We don't, unfortunately, talk enough about what government does from a positive perspective. So those who advocate less government basically have the playing field to themselves. And the result is a lot of people think government's all about fraud, waste, and abuse. But it's
well,
much
both of those programs you mentioned are on the cutting block right now.
21% cut. And this is what's interesting. You know, for those who think, well, they probably spent a heck of a lot of money that, you know, our budget was less 8 years later than it was at the beginning of the Obama administration because we really looked for ways to save money and to be good stewards of the taxpayer dollar.
But $4.7 billion is a lot of money to be cut from any – I mean, that's – well, it seems like you can't do even a fraction of what you were doing.
You're going to cut $500 million out of the wastewater and water treatment program. Now, that basically leverages a substantial amount of additional money, probably – billions of dollars of additional money. Those are jobs that are created in small towns fixing the water system so people have clean water. And it's not something that the private sector is going to pick up and do. See, that's the other fallacy of all this. The theory is, well, we'll just have less government. Well, okay, fine. Then who's going to invest in the water systems? Who's going to invest in the home ownership opportunities for those folks in rural communities? They can't get loans from a commercial bank without the UST guarantee or without a direct loan. So who's going to serve those people? Or are we just going to continue to let rural America erode? And for a guy who was elected in large part based on the strength of his vote in rural areas, it's hard to understand why he would propose such a deep and significant cut to the Department of Agriculture.
Now, just for clarification, your present job, does it have you lobbying?
I don't lobby per se. I educate. There's a difference. My job is primarily on exports in the dairy industry. For example, we're now looking at this issue involving NAFTA. Again, people say, gosh, these trade agreements, bad deal, cost jobs. Well, not necessarily. In agriculture, we have a trade surplus with the rest of the world. We sell a lot more agricultural products than we purchase from the rest of the world. It helps to support nearly a million jobs. In the dairy industry alone, there are over 100,000 jobs that are supported by dairy exports, not just the dairy industry, but dairy exports. So when we sell to Japan, when we sell to Korea, when we sell to Mexico, when we sell to Canada, although it's hard to sell to Canada because they've got a pretty closed system up there, we essentially help to create jobs, and we so obviously support farmers. They, in turn, with a little money in their pocket, can go buy a new combine or a new tractor or a new piece of equipment. That puts somebody to work in a factory somewhere. So it's just important for people to understand that all trade agreements are not all bad, and there's a real concern in Mexico, for example. They're our number one dairy. They purchase a lot of our dairy products. A lot of the dairy that's produced in the state of New York ends up going to Mexico.
But the reason I asked the question about lobbying is you're in a bad spot. You know that he's destroying, Trump is destroying what you've created. And yet you need stuff from him. How does that tension work out?
Well, I've got a good relationship with the incoming Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary Perdue, who was recently confirmed. He was a former governor of Georgia, someone that I served with when our terms overlapped. And I think he understands the importance of investing in rural areas. He understands that a 21% cut is probably too steep. He understands that we've operated the department on a fairly lean budget, and he understands the importance of rural America. So I would hope that once, now that he's confirmed and he's in the room, he can raise his hand when they're talking about trade and say, wait a second, before we get too critical of this NAFTA agreement, let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater here. Let's make sure we preserve the good things we have in NAFTA, which in agriculture, you basically see a trade surplus.
Which may be why the president is pulling back.
Well, here's my attitude about the president. One of the most dangerous things you can have in a government is a smart person who doesn't know what he doesn't know. And I think that's the president. I think obviously he's a smart guy, but I don't think he doesn't know what he doesn't know. And so
is that obvious? I'm sorry.
It's to me, it's painfully obvious.
Okay. Right. I'll give you your.
So, for example, yesterday it was, we're going to leave NAFTA. Well, that just sparked an entire firestorm of activity from agricultural groups, from people in Congress saying, wait a second, you can't withdraw from NAFTA. That's not a good move. And now today it's like, well, we're not going to withdraw, but we might withdraw. He just doesn't understand because he's never been in government. And so he makes these pronouncements and proclamations, and then he has to backtrack, and it creates a lack of credibility.
Does any of this go back, any of the change that we're going through now, go back to the Obama administration? You at one point were reported to be kind of bored in your job. You were giving an extra assignment looking at opioid abuse, which is outside the usual limits of the Ag Department. So are cuts such a bad idea? And if the Obama administration did all these wonderful things that you've told us about in rural areas, how do you account for the massive vote against Democrats and for less government?
Democrats don't know how to talk to people in rural America, and they don't know how to talk about people in rural America. They don't actually go to rural America. So we've not provided a counterbalancing argument to less taxes and less government regulations. There was an argument to be made. I certainly traveled around the country. I went to all 50 states, but we needed more Democratic politicians doing more of that. And something that I advocated during the time that I was in the administration, the need for us to be more present in rural areas. And it's something that I suggested and advocated strongly to campaigns, both presidential campaigns, Senate and House campaigns. And it's also something I think, so number one, we don't show up. Number two, we don't basically support and defend what government does well. We basically have bought into the less government, fraud, waste, and abuse argument and trying to be defensive about government instead of being proactive about talking about the importance of government. And number three, we don't have a strong economic message. It's not enough to go in there and say we want to raise the minimum wage. because a lot of people, when they look at their kids, they don't think their kids want, they don't want their kids necessarily to be a minimum wage worker. So raising the minimum wage to $15 is probably a good thing for those who are actually working those hard jobs. But the reality is it's not something that's going to persuade a lot of people to go to the polls. And here's the real challenge. We have an incredibly innovative economy in America. We're constantly the newest gadget. But the reality is with every new gadget, it impacts oftentimes negatively people that are in the existing economy. Mm-hmm. What we don't have and what the country needs is a transition economy, an economy that essentially is better able to predict how people are going to be displaced by innovation and work with those people early enough in the process so that they are not totally left out in the cold. So, for example, I'll give you an example. We're now all abuzz about driverless cars.
Right.
Driverless cars. Every time I hear somebody talk about a driverless car, I drove a cab to get myself through law school in the summers.
In here Pittsburgh, in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, yeah.
So I'm thinking about that cab driver. I'm thinking about that the truck driver.
Yeah.
What are we going to do for those people?
When you look at the overall the position we're in, we saw the executive order on Tuesday. What do you make of the executive order?
Which one? When you can't get things passed in Congress, what you do is you try to create the impression that you're working.
Well, this is the one he wants Sonny Perdue to identify potential obstacles U.S. ag industry.
So President Obama established the Rural Council, which was all of the federal agencies that had anything to do with rural America, and put me in charge of it. And our job was to try to look at ways in which we could streamline programs, that we could get more help and assistance to folks in rural areas. So a lot of examples of really interesting work. Probably the best example was the Department of Navy, Department of Energy, and USDA entered into an agreement to build a new industry that doesn't exist in this country, which is a drop-in aviation fuel made from plant-based materials. Mm-hmm. It's going to be really good for the military and really good for commercial aviation. So the Rural Council, very effective. So what President Trump did was he disbanded the Rural Council and then established, quote-unquote, a task force, which essentially had the same responsibilities that the Rural Council had. So it's basically trying to project that you're working hard.
It's rebranding.
It's rebranding. It allows them to take credit for whatever the task force comes up with. And I think what will happen is that they're going to learn that there aren't as many regulations and so forth that need to be changed. In fact, oftentimes regulations are a good thing. So, for example, we're going to do away with regulations, so let's do away with food safety laws. Those are regulations. Everybody okay with that?
I think he has done away with them.
Well, you know,
it's cut him out of the budget.
If you do away with food safety regulations, then you're not having your food inspected, and how confident are you going to be when you walk into a grocery store or a restaurant that your family's going to be fed without getting sick?
Well, without sounding overly cynical, but if you don't care about our water and you don't care about our air, why would you care about our food?
Well, let's talk about water and air, this is a good example of how Democrats need to learn about talking to folks in rural areas. It's not that people in rural areas don't want clean water and clean air. They absolutely do, just in the same way people in the cities do. But the rules and regulations are oftentimes not clear, so it's hard for people to understand what's in and what's out, what's right and what's wrong, what's appropriate and what isn't. And then oftentimes they'll invest hard-earned money to try to comply with the rule and regulation, and government will come in and say, well, that's fine, but now you have to do more. A better way, from my perspective on this, it would be to say, look, we want clean water, and to get clean water, we need you to do A, B, and C, and we're going to help you financially do A, B, and C because it's in our interest and your interest to get this done. And then we're going to tell you that once you've done all these things, once you've done A, B, and C, we're not going to come back 5 years or 10 years, for a period of time and tell you have to do more, that you'll have some degree of certainty that the investments you made basically put you in compliance. We did this with the Endangered Species Act out in the western part of the country with the sage grouse, and there was a rebellion going to take place with sage grouse regulations and requirements. Department of Interior, USDA come in and say, you know what, here's the deal. If you do A, B, and C conservation practices, that's going to protect the habitat. You're good for 30 years. We had 4 million acres enrolled in that program, and it turned out that sage grouse wasn't listed because we did a good job of doing the conservation. So there are ways to do this and ways to approach folks in rural areas that we as Democrats, I think we need to figure out how to do a better job.
Do the Republicans know how to do it?
Well, no, but here's what they – absent us not talking about government, absent us not being there, they have the field to themselves. So they come in and say, look, government's not doing anything for you, so we'll have less government. You'll pay less tax. Well, that sounds good. I like that.
What do you have to lose? Yeah, we've heard that.
Yeah, and we'll keep government out of your life. Well, okay, fine. I'm struggling as it is. I don't want anybody else making it more complicated. There's not a countervailing argument that balances or that pushes back against the argument of less taxes and less regulation. There's not the counter argument, hey, for home loans, water projects, conservation assistance, loans for farmers, that's government. That's a positive aspect of government. So let's make sure we protect that. And oh, by the way, let's put together an economy that actually allows you, as these innovations take place, to transition to a better paying job than the one you have. If we'd done that in coal country, if we'd done that in rural areas, we wouldn't have had the election that we had in 2016.
Former Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack is our special guest this morning on the Roundtable. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, I'm Joe Donahue. We're going to take a quick break. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are thrilled to have in our studio Thomas Vilsack. He is the former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture and the 40th governor of the state of Iowa and currently president and CEO of the U.S. Dairy Export Council. He is also an alum of Albany Law School, who will be giving him a very prestigious award with some other great folks today.
You know, the law school... I should be given the law school an award is what I should be doing. I should be the other way around. You know, I was with a group last night from my class. We graduated in 1975. I was the only person in that dinner party last night that didn't have an option in terms of where to go to law school. I applied to 9 law schools, and I was rejected at 8. And Albany Law School was the only law school that had faith in me. And, you know, all this stuff we've been talking about, you know, there's no mayor, there's no state senate, there's no governorship, and there's sure as heck no secretary of agriculture in my future if I don't graduate from law school. And I don't graduate if I don't get in. So I have always been incredibly indebted to Albany, first for giving me the opportunity, and then secondly, it's a law school that focuses on the nuts and bolts of practicing law so that when I went to the small town in Iowa, I knew what I was doing. I felt comfortable in the courtroom, and I had initial success, and that helped obviously to get me into my political career.
I have one follow-up. Do you sometimes think, in light of what we talked about up to now, that had you been the vice presidential candidate, the election would have turned out differently?
Well, I think I could have made a difference. You know, I went through the vetting process twice, once with John Kerry in 2004, and I think I could have made a difference in 2004. And once again in 2016, I think I would have made sure that we spent time in those rural areas. And with my Western Pennsylvania roots, I think it would have been helpful in Pennsylvania. I think Iowa might, even though Trump won by quite a bit, I think I could have made a big difference there. And I think the neighboring Wisconsin, the folks in Wisconsin, people in the rural areas who knew me, they trusted me because I was there. I talked to them. I helped them. I explained things to them. And I think I could have made a difference. But taking nothing away from Tim Kaine, I think I could have made a difference.
You ran for president in 2008.
Well, you know, I did.
I bring this up because I want to go back to the moment where you're talking to your classmates last night and you're saying, oh, yes, this is the last law school. This is the only law school that had let me in. By the way, when I was running for president.
Well, this conversation lasted longer than my campaign. So so we don't want to get too carried away with that. But, you know, it's funny. When I ran in 2007, it was the year that Barack Obama was running, Hillary Clinton was running, Joe Biden was running. I mean, John Edwards. I mean, you know, every superstar in the party was running, and then there was me. And I used to say, you know, I'm not a rock star, but I'm rock solid. And the country wasn't interested in rock solid. And as it turned out, they made a pretty good choice, I believe, from 2009 to 2017. So it was a good experience, and it had me. And I obviously, I think if I hadn't done that, I might not have been considered by the president ultimately for this job that I got.
Hmm.
What kind of conversations do you have with the administration and specifically with the president during your time?
That's a good question.
Well, you mentioned earlier that I was bored, and that's not quite the way I would characterize it. It was a situation where my team at USDA was doing such a great job that I didn't have enough to do, and I wasn't challenged. It wasn't that I was bored. You can't get bored in that job. But I wanted to do more. I wanted to help. And the opioid issue was one that meant a lot to the president and meant a lot to me, for me personally, because my mom suffered from prescription drug addiction and alcoholism, my adopted mom. And, you know, she overcame that addiction and taught me some incredibly valuable life lessons in doing that. So I wanted to be in a position to help. And that is just an incredible tragedy because, first of all, it starts innocently. You walk into a doctor's office years ago and you had a bad shoulder, you had a bad back, and the doctor, wanting to relieve your pain, gives you these pain medications. Been told by the pharmaceutical industry they're not addictive, so no problem. This will reduce your pain, won't cause any additional problems. Well, it turns out that there are a lot of people out there that their brain structure is such that they get hooked and they eventually have to use more. They figure out it's difficult to get more, so they transition to heroin. And so many lives have been ruined. So many lives have been prematurely lost as a result of this epidemic, more than automobile accidents, almost as many as gun violence. And yet there was not an awareness until President Obama put me and his administration on notice that he expected action in this. And it was an interesting conversation because he said, you know, it's really, he said, white males, you know, unlike everyone else in the country, their mortality rate
is going up
and everyone else is going down. Everyone else is living longer except these white males. Why is that? Well, part of the reason was that some of these folks are getting in rural areas in particular, they get hooked because they work physically, they have aches and pains, they don't have access to as much health care as perhaps you might have in a city. There isn't physical therapy close by and things of that nature. They get hooked, and there's in a rural areas it's pretty tough to acknowledge that you've got a problem, because once you acknowledge that, then you can become stigmatized, unfortunately, tragically. You know, if I came into this setting today and told you that I had a son who had cancer, everyone would express great sympathy and feel badly and tell me that their thoughts and prayers would be with my family. If I came in here and told you that my son has a substance abuse issue, what is the reaction? Well, it's a disease just in the same way mm-hmm. cancer is a disease, but our reaction societally is different, and we've got to change that. And one of the concerns I have about the healthcare debate now is that they want to essentially do away with or limit the protections and the coverage for substance abuse and mental illness. Well, how is that any different than a bad back or a diabetes or a heart condition? It's not. And so that's, you know, it's a long answer to your question, but we had substantive conversations like that with the president. This was not photo op. It was, you know, there's a problem. How do we solve it?
I want to switch the topic a little bit because one of the areas of concern for people in the agriculture sector now under Trump is organic and sustainable farming. And even in Iowa, there is, I understand, the Leopold Center, is that right? It's been like a 30-year yeah. program. That's under attack, so it isn't simply Trump. What's your prediction on what's needed and instead what's happening?
Well, the real tragedy will be if the Trump administration decides to pick sides in agriculture.
Right.
You know, agriculture, basically, if you take the most liberal definition of farmer, there are roughly 2 million farmers in America today. But in reality, about 250,000 farm operations produce 80%, 90% of what we grow and raise in this country. So it's a small percentage of America that farms, and they have great needs. And if people within agriculture are fighting over which production method is better or which production method is purer, then they can't educate people about what agriculture generally does for the rest of the country. So every single one of us who's not a farmer has the option of not being a farmer in this country because we don't have to worry where our food's going to come from. All we need to do is have a paycheck to go to the grocery store. Trust me, you travel around the world, do not think that's a given. Mm. It's not. There are many places, in fact, most of the hot spots in the world today, it's not the religion that's causing the problem. It's that they don't have a functioning agricultural economy. They have a lot of unemployed people and a lot of hungry people. Guess what? If we had a lot of hungry, unemployed people in this country, we'd have civil unrest and strife as well. So the agriculture, the strength of our agricultural economy has allowed us to begin layering the American economy with more opportunities, which has allowed us to build this incredibly dynamic economy that we have today. And so agriculture doesn't get credit for that. And also, when you walk out of the grocery store in this country, you walk out with more as a percentage of your paycheck for than anybody else in the world. We spend 10% of our money on food, 10%. You go to any other developed country, it's 20%, 25%. Have your listeners calculate in their head, how would my life be different if I had to spend 10% more of my paycheck for food than I'm spending today? What wouldn't I be able to do? Would I still be able to pay the rent or the mortgage? Would I still have the car that I have? Would I be able to take a vacation? How would my life be impacted and affected if I had to pay a lot more for food? And when was the last time you thanked a farmer? Mm-hmm. So if the Trump administration makes the mistake of saying, you know, only production agriculture matters, right. And that organic and sustainable practices don't, it does two things. One, it divides agriculture again when we spent 8 years trying to bring it together. And secondly, it's the organic, sustainable, local and regional food movement that has created opportunities for younger people to get into the farming business. You know, most kids aren't going to be fortunate enough to inherit a farm. So how do you, if you want a farm, how do you get into the business? It's not like, you know, you rent a front store here in Albany start a business. It's hard, right? But if you can start small and you can negotiate with a local school district, or you can go to a farmer's market and sell your stuff, you can negotiate a price. You don't have to worry about what the Chicago Board of Trade is saying a tomato is worth today. You get to dictate that. So it creates entrepreneurship within agriculture. So my hope is that Secretary Perdue basically says, look, it's not about creating this conflict. It's about how do we support all of agriculture? How do we recognize the important role that organic and sustainable plays? And frankly, every farmer that I know, virtually every farmer I know, is a sustainable farmer, is concerned about stewardship, is investing in conservation. You're part of the Chesapeake Bay watershed in New York. 99% of the land in that watershed currently has some conservation practice underway. People are not, and we've seen improved health in the Chesapeake Bay because of it. Farmers are doing it. But, you know, farmers don't probably tout themselves as much as they probably should.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will go to some letters from our listeners, and we will continue our conversation with former Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. We'll be right back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I'm Joe Donahue, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo are here. We have a special guest. Who is the former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture under the Obama administration. Tom Vilsack is with us, and we couldn't be more pleased. Very nice of you to spend so much time with us. Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to be here.
We have a lot of letters from our listeners, so we'll go through those and wait till you find out what's on their mind.
Well, Secretary, we have heard several letters deal with GMOs.
Yeah.
And this is one of the great controversies.
Oh, good. That's a good question. Yeah, that's
particularly among, you know, the independent left who are very concerned about this. I wonder if you could précis the whole thing for us, or some of it.
Right. Well, look, we've had the science that led to genetically modified crops for quite some time. In fact, some would argue that it goes back maybe the science of altering and the science of editing and the science of changing crops has gone back thousands of years. Genetically modified crops have raised a lot of concern. First and foremost, I believe they are safe. I know that some of your listeners will disagree with that, but the reality is the vast majority of studies have shown that there is not a health hazard associated with GMOs. If there's a challenge with GMOs, it's that it has increased productivity, but it has led to less diversity within agriculture. And I think farmers are now recognizing the need for greater diversity. We had a conversation last night about cover crops at dinner, the importance of the role that cover crops can play, creating better soil health. And so I think you're going to continue to see science develop ways in which we can be more productive, but you're going to see a different kind of science. Instead of injecting something into a crop, you're going to see the genetic makeup of a crop being edited, changed within the crop.
So Charles, who writes us, says, what was once the most of the some of the fertile ground in the world is now a dead zone with respect to many rivers and streams and groundwater. You don't buy that.
Well, I think there is a legitimate concern about the fact that practices over a period of time have led to water quality issues, which need to be dealt with. And that's why it's important to invest in conservation to prevent those nitrates and so forth from getting into the water. And actually, we have seen much less of that going into water than before, in part because of the record amount of acres enrolled in conservation. So that's number one. Number two, the technology has allowed us to be incredibly more productive. So we have less water, less land, less chemicals being used per bushel than we were in the past. And here's the real challenge for mankind. You've got 9 billion people projected population in this world. We will have to increase agricultural productivity. The existing amount of agriculture will have to increase by somewhere between 50 and 70% in the next 30, 40 years in order to create enough food to feed all of those people.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So if we think the world is unsafe today because we fight over oil and we fight over those kinds of resources, guess what? How do you think will be if we're fighting over water and food?
Food and water. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to figure out ways to be more productive, but we have to do it in a sustainable way, and we have to provide and we have to support, I think, publicly financed research. I'm going to give a commencement speech in a couple of weeks at Tufts, and what I'm going to call for in that speech is the development of a political movement around food. You know, we have political movements around healthcare, around the environment, around civil rights. There is no political movement today around food. And one of the issues that we need to address as a people is how do we make sure that everyone has access to food? How do we ensure that it's safe? How do we ensure that it's sustainably produced? And we ought to be asking politicians, asking people who want our vote, to articulate their position on all of those issues. You know, we ask them to articulate is healthcare a right or a privilege? We ask them to talk about the environment, but we don't ask them about food policy very often.
In a way, though, we do, and it has been articulated. Well, Donald Trump thinks that climate change is a hoax, and that plays into everything you've just
said.
That's
an environmental issue. That's not
it
impacts food, but it's not put in the context of food. The question isn't
growing 50 to 70% more.
Right?
Food.
How are you? What is your strategy for ensuring that we in America not only grow enough food, but we help the rest of the world grow enough food so that we have a safer and more secure world? That is a question different than what are you going to do about climate change? Now, the answer to the food question may involve a discussion of climate, but there's no political movement. There's no requirement that we have, quote unquote, a food policy in this country. We have an agricultural policy. We've got an environmental policy. We've got a healthcare policy. We don't have a food policy. And you know, I think developing a food policy could create more cohesion between urban and rural areas than exists today.
Now that's interesting, the urban and rural cohesion, but it seems to me there is an environmental movement that is already well underway, and it is so tied up with food that that's where the connection might be made.
But I think if you start the discussion from a food starting point as opposed to an environmental starting point, you grab more people. Because when you think about food, just think about food generally.
Oh, I like it.
Well, everyone
likes
it. Most everybody likes it. But here's what's interesting. We're going to start reacquainting people here in the month of June, which is Dairy Month, with the important role that dairy plays in their life. I mean, think about every family activity of any note, whether it's a celebration, a joyful occasion, a holiday, a graduation, whatever it might be. Food is at the center of it. Or conversely, if it's something tragic and the loss of a loved one, what do people do?
Yeah.
They bring food.
I'm Italian, I get it.
Food brings people together.
Yeah.
It does not divide people. And in this country, we're so divided. Shouldn't we find something where perhaps instead of dividing us, we can find common ground? Everyone likes food. Everyone wants food to be safely produced. Everyone wants food to be available to people. Is that not potentially the kind of political movement that will not divide us as a nation, but actually create greater unity?
Speaking of which, we have a letter here. Good morning. Well, a local dairy farmer in Cheshire, Massachusetts, told me that he could not sell his milk on the open market, but only to government-chosen organizations at their selected prices. Is this true? Can you summarize how the milk subsidy program works?
Well, that's not true. U.S. farmers have the ability to sell their milk wherever they can find a buyer. Now, they often have contracts and are often connected to a processor. Many producers are part of co-ops that basically, Land O'Lakes, for example, is a farmer-owned co-op that produces butter and dairy products. Dairy Farmers of America, another co-op that produces and processes milk. So it's not true in the United States, but it is true in Canada. And so we're now having a debate and dispute with our Canadian friends about their market. In Canada, basically the Canadian government dictates how much milk can be produced and how much milk can be processed. And they have created systems in their country that make it harder for us to import into Canada from the U.S. We have a much more freer system where Canadian products can come into our country. They have a more restrictive system, and they're now creating a process where many dairies in New York State and in Wisconsin are finding it really difficult because they historically have sold to Canadian processes or to the Canadian market, and they're now being told for the first time that market's no longer open. So that if that's the question, he's right, but it's not the U.S., it's Canada. Now, the subsidy program, there is no dairy subsidy program. There is an insurance program that essentially says and requires farmers to pay in to provide insurance against low prices. In the past 2 years with this new system, farmers have paid $90 million more than they've gotten from the government. So it's hardly a subsidy. It's actually a cost right now for farmers.
Wow.
Let's take a break. We are going to go get news at the top of the hour. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with former Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack and our panel. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Rosemary Armeo is here. Alan Shartok is here. And Tom Vilsack is here, former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture under President Obama. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org.
So, Secretary, I have a question for you. I think many of our listeners are interested in this. I used to have a kid in my class who named Vinny, and he would always say, "So what's it really like?" So I wanted to ask you a "what's it really like" question. What's it really like to be in the cabinet? Do you get FaceTime with the president? Do you go through the gatekeepers? How does that work?
It was a great experience with President Obama. He was a thoughtful guy and was very interested in what you were thinking, what you were doing. So every week we were allowed to write a private note to the president, which he read and often would comment on. If you wanted to have access to the president, all you had to do was ask for time. He was very generous with making the kind of accoutrements of office available to folks. So you had a chance to go to the White House for social events. You had a chance to go to Camp David and see what that was like. You rode on Air Force One. You rode on Marine One. You had a chance to have lunch or dinner with the president. So very open. And always a thoughtful conversation. And the same was true of the First Lady. She was absolutely an equal partner in this process, very much focused on nutrition and wellness. So it was something that we connected with improving school meals and getting kids more physically active. It's something I'm continuing in my work with the Export Council. We have an affiliation with the NFL. Today's draft day. They have a Fuel Up to Play 60 program that involves dairy and getting kids active in schools to spend 60 days on the move, and all of that designed to have a healthier country.
You think the president is playing it right and sort of being subdued and not terribly critical of the
Well, he has to. I mean, that's sort of a given. Presidents historically have basically not been prone to criticize their successors. Certainly George W. Bush respected that with President Obama. Prior to that, you know, President Clinton.
But this guy has been an animal towards Obama. Did I say that? And if anything ever called for a response, this is it. I happen to think he's doing the right thing. Don't get me wrong. But I wonder what you think.
Well, I think the response comes from people surrounding the president. So for today, Dave, for example, there's the tax plan that came out, which clearly is skewed to helping the wealthiest among us become even wealthier. There are people from the Obama administration that are raising questions about the equity and the fairness of the program and raising questions about the impact it will have on the deficit. It'll explode the deficit. So you're seeing the criticisms, you're seeing the concerns, you're just not seeing them expressed by the president himself, president himself.
As well, by the way, as from the Bush administration.
I mean, well, that's right.
A lot of critics are
Well, and frankly, I don't know that there's much love lost on the
board. Sure.
Trump was highly critical of Jeb Bush and the Bush presidency, both Bush presidencies.
So how does it look? I mean, we see right now as 100 days that he has record low approval ratings. What does that mean, do you think? Because the counter to that is that he's still doing very well with that base. But that base is made up of people who live in rural areas.
Right.
And all of what we have talked about are severely going to hurt those people in rural areas. So when does that start to emerge, do you believe?
Well, it won't emerge unless the resistance, the opposition, the Democrats basically make a concerted effort to actually go out and speak to people in those rural areas and basically target messaging to folks in rural America so that there's an understanding. And it will take time because they have been ignored for an extended period of time. By the party, in my view.
So, do they know how to go out and do that?
Well, I don't know. We'll see. I think the first thing that Democrats have to understand is that they can't go out to rural America and say, hey, I'm here to help you. Because that's interpreted in rural America as, hey, you're weak or you're not capable of taking care of yourself, so you need me to help you. It's better for people in the Democratic Party to go out and say, look, we have something to learn here. You have made an incredible contribution to the strength and vitality of this country, and we really should appreciate what you do. We need to learn how can we partner together to create a better economy for you and your families so that you have the same option that any family in a city has. If a kid grows up in Albany, their mom and dad can basically say to them, geez, you know, there's plenty of opportunity for you to stick around in the Albany area if you want to.
Right.
If your kid grows up in a small town, do they have that same opportunity, or are they telling their kids and grandkids, you're probably going to have to leave?
But I understand the argument of the Democrats having to go out and to talk more and to bring these issues up. But obviously, if the people who voted for Donald Trump are hurt by these policies, are they going to realize that they're hurt and turn their back?
Well, look, if they were to pass a health care bill that disenfranchises from health care coverage 24 million Americans, I guarantee you that those people will know that.
Okay.
And I guarantee that will, you know, we're learning a valuable lesson about healthcare. Just to go off on the subject here for a second, there are three aspects of healthcare. There's affordability, there's access, and there's quality. I don't care how smart you are, you can have two of the three. It's impossible to get all three. So what President Obama did with the Affordable Care Act is he said, look, we're going to focus on quality, and we're going to focus on making sure that everybody has access to the care. And the affordability thing, we're going to subsidize. We're going to create tax credits. We're going to subsidize it because that's what we're going to have to do. The focus was healthcare is a right. Therefore, everyone should have it, and we're going to have to figure out how to afford it. Republicans are basically saying, you know, we're all about quality, and we're all about making it affordable. To do that, we're going to limit access because they honestly believe that healthcare is not necessarily right.
That's a great explanation, actually.
Okay. So,
and because they have theirs.
Well, they can afford it. So here's the problem with their strategy. It would be great if the 24 million people that aren't going to have health insurance under their former plan or the people that are going to be disenfranchised under any kind of modified plan, it'd be great if those people stopped getting sick. That'd be great. It'd work. The reality is people don't stop getting sick. In fact, they get very sick and they end up going to emergency rooms. They get care in the most expensive way possible, and, of course, they can't pay for it. So the rest of us, through insurance premiums and so forth, end up subsidizing it indirectly.
Yeah.
So let's be more honest about this and say we're going to say it's a right so everybody has to have access to it. We're going to make it quality. We're not going to make people wait months and months and months to get life-saving health care. And to make it affordable, we're going to have to pay up for a while we figure out as a country how we can be healthier and how we can go longer without having to need chronic disease treatment.
Let's go to some letters. We have a lot of them, and we'll get to as many as we can in a few minutes.
You're going to have to come back.
Yeah. Many of them are very laudatory. Dear panel, I am so impressed by this morning's guest. I worked in sustainable and organic agriculture for 15 years, and I came to the same conclusion that the last thing we need to create is an us versus them mentality. I've long maintained that if we don't support all regional farms, then we won't have any farms to help move along the continuum towards a more sustainable agriculture. It's great to hear about crop diversity and cover crops on the radio. We need to rally behind our farmers and create more opportunities for young people to get into farming. Morning panel, what a great guest. I've been sending letters in the past 6 months saying the Democrats do not communicate with rural America and have given up in the heartland. I'm glad to hear someone who is on the front line confirming my point. Okay. And Daisy says, I've always been a huge fan of the secretary, and you just gave one of the best arguments for being a Democrat and for the power of argument. What are your plans for 2020? Philip says, good topic. Maybe you could ask him a few questions about balancing family farms with big agriculture or about the inheritance tax. In particular, how many family farms are actually lost because of the inheritance tax?
Look.
That's a good question.
Hardly anybody pays the estate tax or inheritance tax. You have to have a farm that's worth more than $5 million, right? $5.4 million, and if you're married, it's $10.8 million, right?
Wow.
So that's the first thing. There are probably some people that have farms, but they end up incorporating. They end up giving shares of stock to their kids. There are a multitude of ways to avoid inheritance tax or estate tax. A small percentage of farms actually have to pay it, and then they're given 15 years to pay it, low interest. So this is not the right tax to focus on, in my opinion. It's the income tax, and here's why. So I'll give you a personal example. My wife and I own a farm. We got it in 1992. It's appreciated 8 or 9 times since I've owned it.
Well,
okay. If I were to sell it today, I would pay a tremendous amount of tax. If I were to sell it to a beginning farmer, I'd pay a lot of tax. If I die and my wife dies owning that farm and we give it to our kids, the next day after we die, our kids could sell it with no tax at all. So essentially, I'm holding on to the ownership of this farm so that my kids get the full benefit of it. Now, instead of focusing on the estate tax that hardly anybody pays, wouldn't it be better for us to say, you know what, if we could create a system where Tom and Christy Vilsack could think about selling their farm to a returning veteran who wants to stay in rural Iowa and farm, or sell that farm to a beginning farmer, and maybe they would transfer the basis that I have so that I wouldn't pay much in tax, if any, or maybe I pay a whole lot less in tax, I might be inclined to sell it to get that into the hands of somebody who would be a young farmer. But there's no incentive for me to think about doing that right now. So, and my kids are going to sell it. They're absolutely going to sell it. So why wait, I hope, 15 or 20 more years before we pass away? Why not encourage me now to do it? So the whole focus of this thing, it just drives me crazy, is that it's the wrong tax. But not many people are thinking that way.
So Philip says, good topic. Oh, no, we did that. All right. Okay. Good morning. A question for the secretary. If government programs help people in places like upstate New York, as you suggested, why is it such a struggle to make them realize the good government does? Shouldn't they already know as the beneficiaries? It seems like so many people suffer from a willful blindness in this respect, and not much can change their mind.
Well, I'm not as pessimistic about the future in that respect. I don't think you can't just tell somebody something once. You have to repeat it over and over and over and over and over again. I mean, if you look at any Republican congressman or senator or governor, they are constantly talking about less government, less taxes, fraud, waste, and abuse. It's a constant drumbeat. Mm-hmm. The media, constant drumbeat. we don't have that same kind of thing going on that explains to that family that just got a loan guarantee that it wasn't out of the goodness of the banker's heart that they've got a home that they now own. It was because the government said, you know what, if you don't make the payments, we'll be there to help you. Mm-hmm. And the banker then said, okay, fine, I've got the government guarantee, I can make this loan. So, I just don't think we market government particularly well. We don't market it at all, especially in rural areas. Plus, you know, we haven't created that transition economy, so people honestly think government doesn't work for them.
Do you think the fact that Trump has caused such a stir among, blue people.
Blue state people.
Yeah,
I was thinking Martians.
Democrats.
Was thinking Smurfs. That's the difference in our
I was thinking
cultural references.
The Blue Man.
Blue Man Group. Yeah. Okay. There you go.
So, don't you think the Democrats have become energized in a way they never would have if Secretary Clinton had won?
Oh, there was no question about that. If Secretary Clinton had won, Democrats would be grousing about one thing or another about why she's not doing something that they think she ought to do. But the energy has to be focused and it has to be funneled and it has to be proactive. It has to be for something, not against something. You can't, in my view, you can't win elections by simply saying, I'm better than the other guy.
Yeah, the other guy's bad.
The other guy's bad. Right. You got to come in and say, look, here's what I'm going to do. Here's what we're going to do together to make your life and your children's lives better. And to mean it and to be sincere about it and to actually be creative. The Democrats haven't come up with new ideas for a long time. It's one of the reasons why I think a food movement could be something that creates different ways of thinking, different ways of approaching problems. But if you look at all of the quote-unquote new ideas that are coming out, they're pretty much coming from conservative think tanks.
Joe, I know you have something else to do, but I want to say this really quickly as a sort of reflection on what you've been saying. Just to echo what Secretary Vilsack said, we received a USDA Rural Economic Development Grant, which allowed our small farm to purchase equipment to expand our dairy business. 3 years later, we're producing thousands of gallons of gelato with cow, sheep, and goat's milk, not all at the same time, thanks to a small $20,000 grant. Grants such as the one we received are virtually invisible to the greater public, but extremely helpful to small rural businesses such as ours here in Herkimer.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the award that Secretary Vilsack is going to be receiving in about 40 minutes. We'll talk about that when we come back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have been really blessed to have in the studio former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture under President Obama, Tom Vilsack, with us. I also want to welcome real quickly Andrew Ayers, who is the director of Albany Law's Government Law Center. Good morning. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you. I wanted you to explain exactly what the award that mm-hmm. Secretary Vilsack will be receiving and mm-hmm. the other recipients of that, because it's a very cool thing.
Great. So this is our the Government Law Center is a small government law focused think tank / mentoring center for students, and we're going to be giving an award to our distinguished alumni in government today. Of course, Secretary Vilsack is the featured a distinguished recipient. We're also going to be celebrating three other alums, Kendra Rubin, who's in the governor's counsel's office. I understand she's just been put in charge of appointments for the governor, as well as Renee Mergis, who's been with the Albany County District Attorney's Office for 31 years, doing a variety of things, including major crimes. And U.S. Attorney Rick Hartounian, who's, as you know, the last of the U.S. Attorneys left over from the Obama administration. And so we're sort of celebrating the diversity of government experience that comes out of Albany Law School. We're also going to be continuing to benefit from a grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for something called the Rural Law Initiative. This is an ongoing project that we have to study issues of access to justice in rural communities. What are the barriers to access to legal services, to access to government services in rural communities? And from a legal perspective, because we're a law school, and so as a nonpartisan think tank, our expertise is not in policy or sociological issues, which are so obviously part of the issue in rural communities. But we're trying to study what are the legal barriers, what are the governmental barriers to access to justice in those communities.
Got to be a lawyer to be a ag secretary, I assume.
Well, Sonny Perdue, I don't think, is a lawyer. Sonny Perdue is a veterinarian.
Is he qualified for the job?
I think he is, and the reason I believe he is that I am sort of biased in terms of governors being able to run the Department of Agriculture for this reason. The department has incredible reach. There is a food safety responsibility. There is the Forest Service that we're responsible for. There is the nutrition programs. There obviously there are economic development programs. There are trade issues that we're engaged in. We have foreign offices in around the world. That's exactly the same portfolio that a governor has. So governors are able to, are required to be able to juggle multiple balls at one time. And so I think a governor is well suited for the job. And I think his agricultural background as a veterinarian, as somebody who's in the elevator business, probably bodes well for him understanding the basics of what's going on in rural areas.
Okay. So I'm going to ask, and then everybody will laugh, but Perdue has a sort of ring to it. Is that the same as the chicken family?
I don't think he's of that family. If he is, he's a, you know, a cousin or different. I think he's related. His cousin is in the Senate, David Perdue, Senator Perdue, and I think he is connected to the Perdue
chicken.
Yeah.
How about immigration policy? How's that going to impact under the Trump administration agriculture?
Well, here's the unappreciated aspect of immigration. The reality is I'd say 70% of all the food that we consume has been touched by immigrant hands, and the vast majority of those hands probably not here with proper documentation. There's a lot of concern and angst in the immigrant community and in the farm worker community over deportation, over basically cracking down. And so the result is that many producers are not farming as much as they could farm, and they're not producing as much, and they're not harvesting as much because they don't have a predictable workforce. It is absurd to think that we're somehow going to deport 11 million people from this country. That would take, I think, 100 or 200 years to go through the legal process to do that, if assuming you could do it. So there has to be some fix here. There has to be some process where people who came into the country without proper authority have got to acknowledge that they did that, and that they have to pay, in essence, some fine or some kind of acknowledgement of wrongdoing. But then they should be given a pathway to legitimacy and to citizenship. It may have to take them a while to get there, but they ought to be given a pathway so that they feel comfortable coming out of the shadows. I think if we had that, we'd have a much more sustainable workforce in agriculture, and we'd be more productive than we already are. And I think if there's one benefit of the conversation here, if they do invest money in making the border more secure, that reduces and eliminates the excuse that has been used by many politicians for not doing immigration reform, that they're concerned about porous borders. Well, you know, our border isn't as porous as it once was, and it's because there's more economic activity in Mexico, and so people aren't coming over as often. So if you want to strengthen the border, fair enough, but at the end of the day, you need to combine that with immigration reform. Otherwise, we're going to continue to have a broken system, and we're going to continue to have agriculture threatened as a result.
Secretary Vilsack, I thank you so much for spending time with us this morning. It's been a real treat to have you on our program, and certainly gain some knowledge from your experiences. It's a great pleasure, and congratulations on the award this morning.
Well, I'm very, very appreciative, as I said earlier, for the incredible gift that Albany Law School gave to me and giving me the opportunity to be a lawyer, and then to train me well enough so that I could have success early in my career. And I think that probably made it a little bit easier for me to get elected to the various positions I got elected to. So I'm glad to be here.
We've had a ton of mail, just I want you to know, saying how great you are, and asking, nominating you for everything from DNC chair to president of the United States.
Holy God. People are not doing me much of a favor asking me to take on that job, I'll tell you.
Albany Law School and the Government Law Center will be holding their award ceremony in just about a half hour. So you all have to get out of here and get awards. I also want to thank Andrew Ayers, director of Albany Law's Government Law Center. And thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. People can find out more about the project you talked about and about the great work that you do at albanylaw.com.
Thank you so
much. Or at edu.
Exactly.
Edu.
Thank
My
you
apologies.
So much.
Thank you very much. Alan, Rosemary, thank you.
Welcome.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.